I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the new movie Precious is winning raves and Oscar buzz for its sobering depiction of a young girl's struggle to survive incest and poverty. But some critics argue it's the same old Hollywood racial politics, and the movie's uplifting ending is just another silver screen fantasy. We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. But first, if you felt threatened on your way to work, what would you do? Take a different route? Change jobs even? Well, what if you're a student and the authorities said you can't leave? Some students who attend Christian Fenger Academy High School in Chicago want permission to transfer to other schools because their school no longer feels safe to them. Their schoolmate, Darion Albert, a 16-year-old honor student, was beaten to death in September in a much-publicized after-school brawl. Now, a federal judge has instructed Chicago Public Schools to discuss transfers with students who filed suit seeking to leave Fenger. But the issue of violence on the way to and from school is not unique to Chicago, of course. Many students in Washington, D.C. are also wondering how they can get to school safely. We're going to go to both cities to hear more. So joining us now is Linda Lutton. She's the education reporter for Chicago Public Radio. She's been following the Darion Albert story closely. Also joining us is Kavitha Cardoza. She covers education issues for member station WAMU in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Michelle.
Now, Linda, this is a rather complicated story, so I'm just going to set the table a little bit for our listeners who may not remember some of the details. Now, Darion Albert, who's a student at Fenger, was beaten to death in September. As we said, this is a story that got a lot of attention owing to some cell phone video that later became available to the public. Now, he was caught up in a fight between a group of students who are from the Altgeld Gardens public housing complex, it's a few miles away, and students from the immediate neighborhood around the school known as The Ville. Now, some of the students who are bussed in are worried about retaliation. Some claim to have received death threats. Now, you were at Fenger immediately after the killing, and you spoke to parents and students. I just want to hear a clip of one student whom you interviewed, Ricky Rankin. He was 14 years old at the time and in the ninth grade, and here's what he told you.
My mom is still worried about my safety, so I'm going to watch my back, and other people should watch theirs.
So, Linda, first of all, what steps have authorities taken to ensure the safety of students coming to and from school?
Well, you know, it's complicated because, as you mentioned, I mean, some of the problems are happening off of school grounds, right? The days that I was there following Darion Albert's beating, there was a very heavy police presence. It was, you know, it felt sort of like a war zone. There were police helicopters overhead, police squad cars up and down every street. You know, some of that has now subsided, but security has been increased around Fenger. And busing is being provided. Most kids in Chicago get to school on the city bus or the trains, and some special sort of school, yellow school buses are taking high school students from Altgeld Gardens up to Fenger High School. So that's one thing. You know, part of the plan of our school CEO here, Ron Huberman, has, you know, he's talked about creating safe passage, working more with police and also with the city buses so that bus stops could possibly be moved, so that bus schedules could more, you know, closely match dismissal times, for instance. But a lot of what the district is talking about, they're still talking about it in the future as sort of plans to come.
Is this the who takes responsibility for what happens going to and from school? I mean, traditionally, when we think about school violence, we think about, you know, Columbine, what happens in the school building. But this is about to and from. So whose responsibility is it? How is that viewed in Chicago? Do the city police see it as their responsibility? Or do they see it as the school authority's responsibility? Or does everybody see it as an individual responsibility?
Well, I mean, it's a good question, and I think people are pointing fingers in lots of different directions. And it is interesting to note, I don't think this is just outside the school. I mean, you know, the teachers talk to me about how communities, you know, fights can start in the community and then sort of fester in school or be brought into school and fester. Or, you know, we also know that things can start in the lunchroom and spill out into the community after school. Chicago Public Schools, you know, continues to point out that no student has been killed on school grounds or, you know, much less in school. But the district has said that this is a problem affecting its students, affecting learning, and it's sort of vowed to tackle it. And I would say in Chicago, CPS has sort of taken the lead on this and, again, is trying to work with police and bring in other city agencies. But, of course, you know, people point fingers at kids. They point them at parents. They point fingers at poverty. You know, many of the high schools, and it's not just Fenger that has a problem with violence and fights and kids being afraid to go to school. You know, they point to the neighborhoods that these kids come from, destitute neighborhoods.
And to that point, it's not just Chicago. I mean, Kavitha, you recently reported on a survey by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention which found that in 2007, nearly 15% of high school students in Washington, D.C. had missed at least one day of school within the previous month because they felt unsafe either in the building or on their way to school. And in that survey, that was the highest rate in the nation. What's behind that number? Why do students feel unsafe going to and from school? Is it a similar situation like we just talked about in Chicago, where kids are traversing neighborhood boundaries to go to schools outside of their neighborhood, and for whatever reason that becomes unsafe?
It's pretty sobering, Michelle, to listen to Linda speak and realize how many of the same issues are going on in Washington. It's a variety of issues. In some cases, it's children, especially those who go to charter schools, which say they don't have problems as much inside the building. But charter schools' kids typically are from out of boundary. So for them, it's going into a new neighborhood. Sometimes, like one school which has had a lot of problems, they are in the middle of two warring gangs. So these children are literally caught in the crossfire on their way to and from school.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the violence that many students are facing on their way to and from school, as well as in the school building. Of course, we're speaking with education reporters Kavitha Cardoza and Linda Lutton. Kavitha covers education in Washington, D.C., and Linda covers education in Chicago. So, Kavitha, the same question I asked Linda is, you recently reported that in Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Police patrol regular city schools, but not charter schools, which are public. But now a third of D.C. school students go to charter schools. So how did that happen, and why is it that way?
Well, the law says that the Metropolitan Police Department will take a responsibility for safety in public schools. And I haven't been able to get the mayor or the police department to comment, but what the attorney general here said was that charter schools are autonomous entities, so they have more flexibility with what sort of security they want. Whereas some members of the city council and, of course, charter school leaders say that's rubbish. You know, these are publicly funded. Children are children. We need the police department to step up. And it isn't just outside on the way, you know, patrolling outside the building, Michelle. It's also police department officials are inside the school building, you know, making, you know, contacts with kids, walking with them to and from school, in communication with street patrol officers to see that these children are safe. But that's just not happening in charter schools.
Linda, you mentioned that school authorities are starting to talk about the effect on education of kids, on kids when they don't feel safe, either going to school or in school. One of the children you interviewed, you recently interviewed a 15-year-old girl that you identify as Kiana, and she says she dropped out of school in March because she was afraid. Let's hear what she had to say to you. Here it is.
Well, I choose not to go to school because I get into too many fights, and I can't hardly learn nothing because the teachers are always hollering at the students.
Well, so Linda, what are authorities saying now about how to address this? And I'm not sure whether this is a behavior issue, you know, what that is that we're hearing.
Yeah, well, I think that this option that kids see, you know, when they confront and what they feel as a, you know, fearful situation, they feel unsafe. I really think that more kids than we realize are choosing to stay home, just don't go to school. And I think we need a better sense of how many kids violence is affecting in this way. You know, Kiana told me again and again she wanted to be at school. She'd try to go back to school, but she would run into problems, conflicts, basically with cliques. I mean, not all of this is gangs. Sometimes you have in Chicago, anyways, these sort of block by block, you know, cliques, they're calling them. That's what the police are using. I think it's interesting to point out, I know the Gates Foundation, big report on dropping out of school called The Silent Epidemic. Something like 57% of kids they talked to said that schools could have done more to help kids feel safe from violence. And they talked about class being disrupted, not being able to concentrate on homework because of this the fear of violence.
So sure, that makes sense. Linda, just briefly, if I may, what's the latest in the case involving the students who want to transfer from Fenger? And I do think it's fair to point out that in the court proceeding, it was pointed out that some 100 students have already been able to transfer out of Fenger. And the issue for these particular students who filed suit is that they don't like the options that have been presented. What's next in this case? Very briefly,
right.
If you would.
Yeah, they don't like the options, and they want immediate transfers, and that has been a problem. It's not easy to transfer here. I'm not sure exactly why it isn't. But it is difficult. The judge has told CPS to meet with the students and arrange for transfers. And I talked to the attorney yesterday for the plaintiffs, and he said some of that is moving forward already. But he's concerned about the kids who may want transfers who aren't plaintiffs in this case. What about them?
And Kavitha, what is the latest in this ongoing discussion in Washington, D.C., which I have to say has become a matter of interest to the local columnists and so forth? What are authorities saying about what they're planning to do to address the safety issues that the students are confronting in Washington, D.C., which to this point has not resulted in a death, but there have been a number of highly publicized beatings and very young students being sort of attacked on their way to school. What are they saying is next?
You know, unfortunately, Michelle, it's not really a conversation as yet. It's more like a one-way charter school advocates and some council members saying things, and we haven't yet had a dialogue about it. It's really tragic because this small startup charter school I'm following, three of their children within the first month, one sister was shot outside another high school. Two others had cousins shot right outside their school. And violence is so, it might not just, it doesn't have to happen to you. These children who are affected, their larger family, even if they do get to school, they're not studying, they're distracted, they're constantly watching their back. That's not conducive to learning.
Kavitha Cardoza covers education issues for member station WAMU right here in Washington, D.C. She was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Linda Lutton is the education reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. She joined us from that station. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Brilliant, brutal, overwhelming, a con job. Those are all words that are being used to describe the new film Precious, which is based on the novel Push by Sapphire. It tells the story of a 16-year-old black girl living in Harlem in the Reagan years, whose impassive face and huge girth are no mask for the pain she is carrying, the pain of unrelenting physical and sexual abuse at the hands of both parents. But somehow, she finds a way to survive. The film, produced by entertainment superstars Oprah and Tyler Perry, and produced and directed by Lee Daniels, who also produced such provocative films as Monster's Ball and The Woodsman, has already scooped up awards at various film festivals and been touted as Oscar material. But it has also opened up some difficult conversations about race and poverty, about sexual abuse, and about skin color, even about how black filmmakers portray dark-skinned people. In a few minutes, we'll talk more about just how real Precious is, how real her story is. We'll talk to a human rights activist who advocates for incarcerated women, many of whom have been victims of exactly the kind of abuse depicted in the film. But first, we're going to talk about some of the cultural conversations being sparked by Precious. The online magazine The Root has published a number of pieces related to the film, and two of the writers are with us now. Teresa Wilt is The Root's senior culture writer, and she's also serving as interim managing editor. She's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio, along with Jada Smith, who is a writer at The Root. Welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Teresa, as I mentioned, The Root has published a number of pieces about this film. Why do you think there's so much interest in it? Is it just because it's a big Hollywood rollout with a lot of big stars? Or is there something else about it that you think makes people want to talk about it?
I think both. There's been an enormous amount of buzz about this. I mean, it's got the Oprah stamp and the Tyler Perry stamp. But it's really this little art movie. And, you know, we don't normally see stories about girls such as Precious.
What did you think of the film? I mean, you were one of the people, you not only sort of edited the package and brought pieces into the package, you kind of started the dialogue and encouraged the dialogue about the film, but you also wrote a piece about the film. So
right, I did
what,
review it. I really, I liked it. I mean, I found it to be a work of art, frankly. I mean, I just thought it was lyrically beautiful to watch, but it wasn't just beautiful to watch. I mean, there was this emotional resonance to it. He has a lot of, you know, little tricks, filmic tricks we see. Precious's longings come to life. So she's looking through a photo album, and the pictures are talking back at her. and they're reassuring her and they're cooing to her. Or she looks in the mirror and fixes her hair and she sees this pretty white girl with blonde hair. So I loved that it just brought us into her interior life. I think it's hard to do that.
Everyone did not love the film. Jada, you took issue with one specific aspect of the film, and your piece is titled, "Does Hollywood Still Have a Brown Paper Bag Test?" What did you mean by that?
I meant the casting. All of the negative people in Precious's life, her mother, her father, even herself, which she has a poor self-image, she has poor self-esteem, are all dark-skinned. And all of the positive people in her life are all light-skinned, the people who uplift her and who help her overcome her issues. The nurse, played by Lenny Kravitz, the social worker, played by Mariah Carey, and her teacher. In the book,
Miss Rain, who's played by Paula Patton in the film.
Mm-hmm. She has dreads, she's brown-skinned. And in the movie, she is light-skinned, Paula Patton. And even in Black Hollywood, it's directed by a Black director and produced by Oprah and Tyler Perry and Lee Daniels, that colorism, as far as light people are good, dark people are bad, is still portrayed. Maybe it was overt, maybe it was covert, I don't know, but I definitely noticed it.
One thing that some people are surprised by is that there isn't more criticism of the portrayal of a Black family in film. And one of the pieces that The Root printed also sort of reflects on the fact that 20 years ago, when The Color Purple, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Alice Walker, was made into a film, there was tremendous criticism about the portrayal of Black men, which is similar. I mean, it was set in a different context. It was rural, but the themes of incest were there, of this overwhelming brutality was there. And many people said, why do we need to see this? And it's interesting because Sapphire, the author, who does not use her real name in her work, did not permit this novel to be made into a film for a very long time. Many people asked for the film rights. She refused to give them. She was asked by my colleague, Michelle Norris, on the program All Things Considered about that. And she was asking, you know, why she finally did agree to turn it into a film. And here it is.
Well, now in 2009, we have tremendous range of Black families in the media, from the Cosbys to the Obamas. So now I think we are safe enough and secure enough to show this disease situation with the hope that we can see it as something that needs to be healed as opposed to something that we need to hide from the public's view.
Teresa, I want to ask you about that. Do you think that's true?
Well, I do think that it's true. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, the fact that we have the Obamas in the White House is kind of a powerful counterpoint to any kind of negative depictions that you might see in the media. I personally still get very frustrated by what I see in Hollywood. I feel like, you know, I go to the movies with my husband and we walk away feeling like we've just been sitting for 2 hours watching white people's lives. So I still feel that there's a big dearth of experiences. But compared to what was out there in 1984, when The Color Purple came out, it's very different.
But are some of your readers saying, well, see, this shows what I said all along, that these people do have all these problems? And
definitely. I mean, you definitely have, you know, the people who are going to look at this. Is this and this is one thing I've taken issues with Oprah when she says we're all precious, because I feel that it denies Precious specificity of her own story. So, you know, that she's a stand-in for all Black people. And there are going to be people, and we've had people on the site who thinks this is just a stand-in for Black dysfunction and, you know, proof positive of that. So, and that's always, I think, the push with Black art is like, can you be authentic or do you have to be presenting this varnished, prefabricated image of everything, cosmified image of everything being wonderful, which I think is limiting. We need to have many, 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 many stories about Black lives. And this is just one story. And it's one story that to me is told very beautifully. And clearly we're hungry for this because it's getting this a tremendous amount of reaction.
Teresa Wiltz is The Root's senior culture writer. She's also serving as interim managing editor. Jada Smith is a writer for The Root. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to read the pieces that we've been talking about, as well as a number of others about Precious, please go to our website. That's npr.org. Click on Programs and then Tell Me More. Just how real is Precious? Part of the buzz around the film is the sense that it is unblinking in its gaze at the life of its central character, an abused Black girl living in Harlem that nobody seems to care about, until a social worker and caring teacher link arms to give her the tools she needs to pull herself out of her sad life. But some people say that's just as big a fantasy as Star Wars. I'm joined by Malika Sadassar. She's the executive director and founder of the Rebecca Project, which works with vulnerable women and children. She recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post on the real-life Preciouses who live in many of our communities, and she joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You write that 1 in 3 American girls will experience sexual violence by age 18, regardless of race or class. And you say that even though the film was powerful in bringing the lives of these girls to public attention, what actually happens to them in real life bears no relation to what happens in the movie. So tell us more about that.
Indeed.
What does happen to most of these girls?
Most of these girls wind up behind bars. When you look at our girls who are in the criminal justice system, they are there because they have been hurt by incest or by other forms of sexual violence. And that is the shared narrative of these girls who are detained. They get detained because they are running away from home. Well, they're running away from home because they're running away from the abuse at home. It's interesting. We tell our women who are in situations of violence that they ought to run away from their batterer. When girls run away from those who are hurting them at home, they're arrested and put behind bars. And then the other reason why we have so many girls behind bars, more girls behind bars than at any other point in our history, is because of trafficking. You know, we often think about trafficking in terms of girls abroad in India or Costa Rica or Thailand. But within the U.S., girls are being trafficked. And I'm talking about American girls, girls who are born and raised in Dayton, Ohio, in Harlem, New York, in Compton, California. These girls are being trafficked. And when they are caught by the police, they are put behind bars.
Why is that? I mean, one of the reasons that I think many people have a hard time understanding how trafficking could exist in this country is that presumably if you are born in Harlem or Dayton, Ohio, you speak the national language. And we associate trafficking with girls who are brought across borders mm-hmm. deliberately so that they will not know where they are mm-hmm. or how to get help. So how is it possible that this continues in this country when presumably girls can figure everybody knows to call 911? Why doesn't that work?
Because many of the girls get kidnapped by the pimps, because many of the girls are runaways. The same girls who are running away from the abusive homes are being preyed upon by the pimps. There's a powerful story done in the New York Times showing how the pimps know to prey on and identify the runaway girls by how they look, by how they dress, by the runaway shelters they go to. And so these girls become vulnerable to the pimps, and the pimps become the only individual showing love, care, concern for the girl. And that's the pimp's way of entrapping, of ensnaring girls into lives of prostitution.
As we see in the film Precious, which I know you saw, that one of many of the performances have been lauded, but one of the central characters, of course, is that of the teacher, Miss Rain. What about the character of the teacher? I just want to play a short clip for those who have not seen the film of just how pivotal this teacher is to the character of Precious kind of coming out of her despair. Here it is.
My favorite color is purple. I sing well. And I'm here because I love to teach. Paris, something you do well?
Nothing.
Everybody's good at something.
The point being that this teacher becomes her lifeline because mm-hmm. she's the first person to show mm-hmm. Precious the kind of affection and regard and to see her as a person. And so, Malika, are you saying to me that there is no such Miss Rain, that Miss Rain doesn't exist?
Oh, no, I think there are many Miss Rains. Whether or not the educational system keeps those Miss Rains, whether or not those Miss Rains are able to really impact the lives of girls as shown in the movie is another question. Look, I was probably not as good as a Miss Rains, but I was a Miss Rains in the high school system in California back in 1993. I went from Stanford Ed School and went into the educational system believing that I could save the lives of girls like Precious by being a teacher. And I worked so hard with so many girls like Precious to make that difference. And at the end of the year, I recognized that unless we change the policies on the national and state level, girls like Precious don't have a chance.
What would make a difference for girls like Precious?
Well, first of all, we have to stop incarcerating girls like Precious. So we cannot have one girl behind bars because of sexual victimization. When girls are trafficked, they deserve a place to go to heal, to recover, and to be whole. And girls like Precious deserve schools that can teach them. We don't have real programs for teenage mothers or girls dealing with issues of trauma and violence to go to. We don't have those kinds of gender-specific girl programs. I met a 13-year-old girl who was a survivor of incest. Her uncle was raping her, and she had a baby from another man as a way of stopping him from raping her. I didn't meet her at a special incest survivors group. I met her in the juvenile justice system of Delaware. That ought not to be. We ought to be very thoughtful about the kinds of programs that we establish for our girls at the margins. And right now, we don't have those programs.
Why was she in a juvenile justice? Why was she in juvenile detention?
Because she was truant from school. And she was truant from school because she was taking care of her baby.
What role do you think that sexual abuse of the kind depicted in the film Precious plays in the presence of girls in the criminal justice system?
Well, I think they're in the criminal justice system because of the sexual victimization. So the sexual victimization has cut them down because it has pushed them out of the interior of the community and our families and our structures of learning. These girls feel less than, they feel other, they feel unworthy. And there is the expectation of just deal with it. So when these girls are hurt, there are no places for them to go to deal with the issue of the violence and trauma. They are expected to simply endure it and move on.
There are many people, I think, who have the view that girls today are much more sexually aggressive than girls in the past. So they, I think, may have a hard time seeing girls as victims in that way. They see girls who seem to be very provocative, very forward in their dealings with men and boys.
I think that's a narrative that we push intentionally so that we don't look at what's underneath. And what's underneath are some very, very upsetting statistics. 1 in 3 girls being subject to sexual abuse by the time she's 18. There's also the statistic that girls between the ages of 16 to 19 are 4 times more likely to be raped than the general population. So I think that we can tell ourselves this narrative of girls being comfortable with more sexualization and that there's a power from sexualization. And it allows us to ignore the very bitter truth of what girls go through around sexual victimization.
You say that we still are not, as a society, being real about the degree of sexual violence directed at girls. I mean, we talk about it a lot in the context of war zones and conflict zones in other parts of the world. But you're saying, you know, this is right here, there's trafficking. Right here, there's a lot of sexual violence directed at girls. I think a lot of people have the idea that this is a society that talks about everything. Everything's out there. Everything's on the table. Why do you think that this still is not discussed?
It's a question I ask myself every day. It is unbelievable to me that we can have celebrities talk about the most important cause being trafficking in India or the Congo or what's happening to girls in Thailand. There's an unbelievable international movement around protecting and defending girls trafficked. And there's an eagerness to be part of that movement. And yet I don't understand why we can't bring that commitment to girls, to those daughters right here in the U.S. who are struggling. Perhaps it feels too close. Perhaps these are issues that feel too visceral when we talk about them within our homes and our communities. But we have to do this. And I think this is my hope for the movie Precious. Can it be used as an opportunity to be brutally honest about what our girls are enduring in the U.S.? Can we really have a very honest conversation about the unacceptable levels of violence against our girls, not just our girls at the margins, not just the girls in Harlem, because it's not just about girls in Harlem. It's about every girl in every family, in every community, in every state. And we have to get prepared and honest and brave enough to have that conversation.
Malika Sadassar is the executive director and founder of the Rebecca Project. If you want to read more about what she has to say, especially a piece that she wrote for The Washington Post, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on programs, and then go to Tell Me More. Malika joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Malika, thank you again.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. When you first see Andrew Mayer Cohen, a.k.a. Mayer Hawthorne, your first question might be, is this guy for real? He has the look of a guy who doesn't get out of the library much, with a cardigan, dark, thick-rimmed glasses, and he sings in a falsetto from a genre whose heyday was decades ago. But Mayer Hawthorne really loves his Motown throwback soul music, and now he, along with his band, are winning over audiences and critics with their easy rhythms and full-bodied harmonies. Hawthorne grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and got his start as a hip-hop DJ. He's currently on tour supporting his new album titled A Strange Arrangement. And Mayer Hawthorne joins me now in Studio 4A to talk about his musical journey. And his band is also here. We're delighted to have everybody here. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
How do you do? Thank you for having us.
Why don't you introduce the band, though, before we get started?
All right. Well, first of all, everyone in my band goes by their Mayer Hawthorne name.
Okay.
So I'm going to introduce everybody by their Mayer Hawthorne name, and then we'll give you your real names, too. So
okay.
On keys,
just in case there are papers out there
on
somewhere.
On keyboards and vocals, we have Quincy McCrary, a.k.a. Eugene Doheny.
Good morning.
On the guitar and vocals, we have Topher Moore, a.k.a. Jimmy Yellowstone.
Yes, yes.
And then on the drum set back there, we've got Quentin Joseph, a.k.a. Sweet Baby Lorraine. On the bass guitar and vocals, we've got my man Joe Abrams, a.k.a. Leon Wolverine.
So, do I get a new name? Can I get one?
What's your middle name?
Denise.
Denise, and what's the street you grew up on?
Lincoln Avenue.
Denise Lincoln?
There Denise Lincoln?
There it is.
Okay, there it is.
You're hired.
I feel like I might regret this, but I don't know why. Anyway, so how did you fall in love with soul?
I grew up just outside of Detroit, Michigan, in Ann Arbor, listening to Motown and oldies with my father, and I would ask an incessant amount of questions about every song that came on, you know. That's the Four Tops, you know, that's the Temptations, that's David Ruffin. I always wanted to know everything I could learn about the music.
In fact, you played quite a few instruments, and you played on the album most of the instruments, and you also did your own backup. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And why is that? You just...
Well, part of it is the challenge of playing the whole thing myself. And then the other part of it is, you know, I hear the songs very vividly in my head, the complete arrangement of it, and, you know, it has a certain feeling that is difficult sometimes to explain to another musician, and, you know, if I can just play it myself, it's easier.
Is it hard now, though, that you're on tour to give up control now that you have to introduce the other folks?
No, because my band is made up of all my favorite musicians in the world, and each one of them is better than me at any of the instruments that I play, so it's really easy to hand the controls over to them.
So why don't we play something from the new album? What do you want to play first?
We're going to play the first song that I ever wrote. It's called Just Ain't Gonna Work Out.
All right, let's hear it.
You know, NPR, I know you think we can all make it work out, but I gotta tell it like it is, and I don't want to make this any harder than it needs to be, so don't cry. Short and sweet.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and we're speaking with Andrew Cohen, better known by his stage name, Mayor Hawthorne. His new album is called A Strange Arrangement, and we just heard, just ain't going to work out. So, Mayor, I have to ask, what's up with all these Mac Daddy songs on this album? Were you giving somebody the pink slip, relationship-wise? What's going on?
You know, I've been a hip-hop DJ and producer for the past 10-plus years, and, you know, hip-hop does not lend itself as well to songs about relationships and heartbreak. And I think all these songs have sort of been building up for the past 10 years. And now that I've got this soul outlet, they're all sort of flying out at once.
Okay, and, but how come you're doing all the flying out?
Oh, I'm not.
That's what I'm saying. What's all the flying out is on you?
I'm not. I make mistakes too. I get dumped.
On the other hand, you've got, how can we put it? This kind of nerd boy persona going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've always been sort of a nerd. I mean, I'm a music nerd. I'm a vinyl record collector, and I studied computer science in school, and that's just sort of who I am. But, you know, my nerdiness has allowed me to get to where I am with the soul music and all the studying that I've done and breaking it down over the years and figuring out what makes a great soul record.
Now, how did you go from being a hip-hop DJ to a R&B crooner?
Well, that was never really my game plan. I moved out to Los Angeles about 3 years ago to pursue a career in hip-hop music, and I ran into the CEO of Stone's Throw Records, a gentleman by the name of Peanut Butter Wolf, and I knew about Stone's Throw. It was already one of my favorite labels, but I was still pushing my hip-hop music. But when I got introduced to him, I was introduced by a mutual friend who had heard my Mayor Hawthorne demos. I recorded a couple of songs of this soul music just sort of for fun on the side as an experiment. And I really had never planned on those songs ever being released or even heard by the public. But my friend who had heard them, she said, "Yo, Wolf, you got to hear these Mayor Hawthorne songs." Peanut Butter Wolf wrote me back about a month later, and he said, "Hey, these tracks are fantastic, but what is this? You know, who is this?" And I said, "Well, it's me. They're my songs. I played all the instruments and sang everything and recorded it all in my bedroom." And once he realized that that was what was going on, he asked me to record a whole album's worth of material for Stone's Throw. So that sort of changed the course of my life significantly.
How do you feel about it?
You know, in some ways, it's a little frustrating that I spent that long, you know, trying to make it in hip-hop, and then it was a project that I never even planned on releasing that ended up getting all the attention. But, you know, you gotta be happy about anything that people are feeling that much. I have so much fun making this music.
And firing all these girls, whoever they are, that you get to kiss.
Firing them all, yes. But, you know, it's...
In song, at least.
This past year has just been unbelievable. I mean, it's really surreal.
Let's play something else. What else do you want to play?
I think let's do my version of Electric Light Orchestra's Mr. Blue Sky.
Okay, here it is.
And then we're going to segue that into an original of mine called Green Eyed Love.
All right.
Shining in the sky, the rain a cloud inside. It stopped raining, everybody's in the play. And don't you know, it's a beautiful new day. Hey, burning down the avenue, see how the sun shines brightly in the city, on the streets where once was bidding Mr. Blue. Sky is living here today. Hey, Mr. Blue Sky, tell us why you had to hide away for so long. Where did we go wrong? Hey there, Mr. Blue, we're so pleased to be with you. Look around, see what you do. Everybody smiles at you. Hey there, Mr. Blue, we're so pleased to be with you. Look around, see what you do. Everybody smiles at you.
come to shove, I need you. Yeah, you're in my blood. Whoa, my love. Unlawfully wet. Take me outside of it all when I'm stuck. Ooh, in my head. Yeah, well, they say, they say, they say that you're no good for me. Ooh, but I know, I know, I know now, but that's a lie. Oh, and sometimes, oh, sometimes I just don't know anymore.
Very nice, very nice, thank you. Andrew Cohen, known as Mayor Hawthorne. His new album is called A Strange Arrangement. So what do you think people are responding to? You mentioned that this is kind of an accidental thing for you. This wasn't really what you'd planned. What do you think people are responding to?
The only thing that I can really boil it down to is that it's the fun factor of it. And that, you know, I'm having so much fun with this music, and I think it really comes out in the music, and you know, everyone just wants to have a little fun.
Can I ask you about the race factor? You know, a lot of people think of soul as an African American art form, right? And are there any feelings about your being a white guy from Ann Arbor?
You know,
picking up the soul mantle.
I think the majority of the people that hear my music for the first time have no idea what I look like, and you know, the general reaction has been shock, you know, when people really, they see a photo of me afterward. And, you know, that sort of tells me that at least I got the vibe down, and nobody's, you know, really had too much to say about that yet, you know.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because sometimes, like, there are white artists like Kali Buds in reggae, for example, who's from Bermuda. People are like, what's up with that? On the other hand, do you feel you have an extra hurdle of sincerity to cross, or are we over that?
I'm sure I'll run into it at some point, but you know, hopefully people can listen to it with an open mind and appreciate the music for the music and not pay attention to the color of my skin.
What's next for you? What do you want to do next?
Well, we're going to be touring, you know, clear through 2010, but I'm already working on songs for the next album, and I'm also working on a couple other music projects as well, you know, some hip hop, some boogie funk. I'm not gonna limit myself. I'm always experimenting and trying new things and trying to move the music forward. You know, it's very important to me that even with this project that I don't create a throwback or retro album. You know, I wanted this album to have that timeless feel to it, and you know, I wanted people to get that warm feeling that they get when they listen to classic Motown or soul. But it's important to move the music forward and, you know, to be trying new things and to bring it to a new generation. And it's really important for me that kids that are listening to this music that are growing up right now don't feel like it's their parents' music. It's new. You know, I'm a new artist living in 2010, and that's a big deal.
Andrew Cohen, known as Mayor Hawthorne. His new album is called A Strange Arrangement. It is available in stores now. For more information about the band, please check out our website at npr.org. All the best to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
What would you like to go out on?
We're going to go out with a bang on the last song that I wrote for the album. There was a lot of heartbreak and emotional outpouring on the album, and I felt like I needed to balance it out with a little upbeat positivity. So the last song that I wrote is a song called The Ills.
Okay, here it is.
Refers to the ills of the world, as I call them.
All right, Mayor Hawthorne, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you again for having us. Gone.
is her son. You know the ills of the world, they can get you down. You know the ills of the world, they can get you down.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.